And in asking myself again, are you sure this is what you want to do, that you can use these with integrity, that you can use these in priority and propriety? And I answered yes, that this is what I must do. And so that brings me kind of like every day is a day-to-day situation, but I don't worry too much because the problems seem to resolve themselves, but it takes work, it takes dedication, it takes a cause. Yesterday I spoke to our congregation about causes, who has a cause, and of course a lot of people raised their hands up and they all had wonderful causes, but nobody had a cause of themselves. They were not their cause. And I mentioned that if you are not a cause, if you are not your primary cause, then what you do cannot be of that great a benefit, because it's going to lack. It's going to lack in tenacity and drive and passion. So you must have a passion for your cause. You must have a passion for yourself. You must be able to love yourself unconditionally. And in that, raise a passion. You become more efficient and effective, affective and effective, and can do those things which are necessary to bring about those changes. We live in a difficult and critical times where things are disintegrating. People say we are quickening or speeding up. I say we're slowing down. We're able to see what we have done, what we have created. And now we're trying to find ways in which to minimize the what's going to happen as a result of all of this. We call it the purification time. In our traditional things, our oral tradition speaks of it. So how is it that we can minimize? We realize that we are not prepared for any great emergencies or catastrophes. Our blood supplies don't exist. The ways in which to deal with things do not exist. The ways to find alternate transportation do not exist. And so that if we are cut off and colonized, so to speak, into small communities, how much of that community is going to be able to sustain itself or willing to support each other in a very necessary process? So we're getting back into a communal time, tribes and bands. And egos must be put aside. We must put aside egos, and we must be able to work with the well-being of all people within our group. Because that's the only way that survival can really sustain itself, is the willingness for all to work for a cause, the cause being the sustaining of whatever it is we believe. And whether it's religion or politics or jobs or business or money, we're in a great time of change. Things are changing consistently and constantly. And we will go through it. We will go through it. We will pass through this time. It's an amazing process. So for the most part, briefly, that's who it is, and that's what happened. And as again, Sam, it's an honor for me to be here and to share with you what little there is. I will be producing 7 videotapes. We have already started production and filming and some of the issues and aspects of it, where we will sit in discussion before a live audience and explain these things in more detail, what they were encompassing, what they were about, how they were seen. From one perspective, not that this is for you to take and to say, yeah, I agree with you or don't agree with you, but just to offer to the world, such as Joseph Campbell did and Bill Moyer did in the Campbell series of what it was that they translated in, myth and mythology and the different issues there. We will be doing just that, offering a different perspective in a different way, and hopefully articulate enough, but yet simple enough for everyone to consume it who views it or hears it. The thing that I ask about this experience is people don't talk about it, but if you want to share it, give somebody the tape, make them a copy of the tape and share that with them, because if you were to talk about it, you would change it based upon your perspective and life experiences and what the words mean and the emphasis and the accents and the punctuations and so forth. And so I just simply ask that as a requirement, because that's how much it means to me as a human being, that it's that important to me. So I thank you again for allowing me to be here and be in your presence and in your light. the power of your light, the power of your sacredness, and the fact of your, you know, your spirituality and all of those things which encompass this group here and the extended group, because you're all over. I want to thank you for allowing me to be up here this morning and be with you for this short time today. It's my honor. And my brother Bud, who drove me up here, worrying about me not being able to see the road. Bud, would you stand up? That's my Bud there, Bud Sepulveda. My good brother. So, I've done what you asked me to do.
For the moment.
May as well just go.
Yeah.
That'll be the date.
You need to take that off, yeah? Okay.
This is the on and off.
The armor is ours. I would appreciate it, EJ, if you would get that box in here. For a long time, Dharma carried around this picture of Little Crow. Didn't look like Carl Bryant. Didn't look like Little Crow. Didn't look like God. And it was almost an obsession. And as only God will work it for you ones who have your intentioned trinkets. When she could, she got it. Just pull it out.
I'll do that in a quick second.
It's not a statue of God. It is a recognition. True recognition. You know, she runs out, she finds a red-tailed hawk, so she gets it, because he's also the red tail, and he comes and visits her a lot. And most of you in this room are not even going to know that this particular item exists in reality. This is from our heart to you. This is the spotted eagle owl, and this is the way we know our brother best. And we especially like this one because in the talons, you will see, he's got the snake. Well, I see. EJ, you've done it again. You've made a mess. I think we should take a little break after this because I would like her to be able to enjoy this.
Spotted eagle owl. So I'm very grateful and humbled.
of this. Thank you very much.
Great honor. Thank you all. Thank you, sister.
How small this world is. Now this would appear to be a piece of porcelain, which is exactly what it is. Don't give it any power. The power held in this article is simply a recognition and an honor for what we each come to recognize in the other. It's like a talisman. Any kind of ritual, you know, the Indian will get his gourd and he'll rattle it or whatever, and he'll wave his feather or whatever. Only what you give something is the power that it holds. Don't give foolish power to anything. But appreciate what it represents to you when you see it or look upon something. It will always touch you because this is the reality of the meaning of anything. And we must come into brotherhood where we begin to understand what these things mean, soul to soul. Recall some of the traditions in honor and respect of that which we come to recognize and understand and are allowed to hold for a little while. And then always you need to have the mundane to bring down the egos from those mountaintops into the understanding of the reality of what it is we're about. And always we wonder what it is we're about. Well, wouldn't it be nice for little crow or spotted eagle owl or whatever one is recognized by label to just be able to curl up in his fetal position and say, I'm going to just give you 5 hours a day. When he knows full well, he'll work harder the rest of the time. So he can tell himself anything he wants, and he can tell you anything you want to hear. But the facts are that God is going to evolve back into your recognition as a reality of your very experience. And that means that you ones who have accepted purpose, accepted responsibility, will move forward. And no man is an island, because all men are but one. And at some point you have to come into understanding what that means, and it doesn't mean you can sit there in a lotus position waiting for enlightenment to fall on you along with the gold coins. Which do you want first, the enlightenment or the gold coins? Well, of course the gold coins, and then I can buy enlightenment. But don't count on it. And once little crow said, in this great odyssey, what do you gain by all of this wondrous insight and knowledge, save restless, sleepless nights, responsibility you'd rather not shoulder? But oh, you wouldn't give it away for anything the world could bring to you. Not even the misery that you experience, because once you are enlightened, you know of the game. and you can make a big deal of the game and your important role in it, or we can just move along here and get it done. And that's what we're going to do. He can't just say, well, my great wisdom now is fulfilled and I know it'll just flow off me like the vapor all about, and the Indian nation will come again into its senses and get off the alcohol bottle and we'll just all live happily ever after. We know that that is not so. Because no matter how happily he may live, he cannot do it for any other brother. Not a one. There are some mountains you climb all alone. Just you and God. And if you can't get to the top of that mountain, then you don't have any faith in God. And that's the way it is. We're going to climb the mountain. And we're going to do it right. And we're going to do it in brotherhood. And we're going to do it in love. And when we speak of unconditional love, that does not mean that God does not put conditions on your experience and your relationship in truth. It means that you have absolute love. And when you can absolutely love your own self as a projection, and once again, Walter, I'm going to say it, I don't care what Coyle says. Dorma can handle it. You are the manifest thought projection of God. What do you reflect back? Well, today we reflect back better than we did yesterday because we have a little inkling more of understanding and insight. So when you go out and you say, well, I have unconditional love. Number one, in the vernacular or language definition of mankind means, well, I'm so damn pious that I'm going to bestow my great intelligence, forgiveness, whatever, absolution on you. What you're looking for is absolute love, beyond which you don't count the conditions you allow. It doesn't mean that you have a right to sit back on your fanny and say, I allow everything. No, you forgive every man. But you don't forget the action, lest you again become what you have become in the center of a dark pit. The remnant has to get through. What are we about? We're about providing hope, possibility, experience, trying to change circumstances so that there comes a little bit better balance, a little bit more gracious care for that which we've been given to experience, to be birthed from, to come out of. And our brothers won't prepare. They don't understand. They don't know. They don't know. So our symbology that we utilize, whether it be a statue or whether it be God itself in light, God is light, and you are the manifest thought of God's thought projection. His whole, W-H-O-L-E without H-O-L-E-S's. You are the whole perfect thought of God. And then you get busy to cover it up so that your reflection is dimmed and finally put out, if possible. And even this little statue is funny. The people who own the mint, this is from Franklin Mint, which most of you have heard of. But guess what? The Franklin Mint is owned by some people called Resnick. All of you know little Faye Resnick from O.J. Simpson. These are the Resnick family. Very, very wealthy. Why would we be interested in even speaking of people who own the Franklin Mint, whereby, you know, you go and use Taiwanese labor, cheap labor, whatever? Well, it's interesting because they own the Tejon Ranch. And I don't know about the rest of you, but I thought we intended to own the Tejon Ranch. So isn't it nice to find the owner so that we know who to bargain with? It's called negotiation. We won't compromise, but I fully intend to get enough of that yellow stuff, you know, bananas. And these places around will be a security, because God's land cannot be owned, but you try to tell that to the judge. So we don't need to go and plead with a judge. We will do it properly according to the way of man. We don't have to be disrespectful about it. I told you long, long ago that if you did this right, our enemy would help us. And I want to tell you, Mr. Bush is going to. And we talk about Mr. Kissinger and we wonder who's Kissinger now. Well, we're going to find out that they need a market for their things that they have stolen. It's called fencing. I'm very happy to use their fenced materials for our collateral. Money is not good, and money is not evil, and you don't even miss it except to the extent that you don't have it. So I suggest we get it. And then we have it to be utilized for the better things and the evolvement and the allowance and the freedom it will give us to grow. As far as I am concerned, it has absolutely no value other than the value we give it. And we need it, so we're going to give it some value. But we're not going to pass it out so you can go and get us back into trouble by buying your little fire engine red Ferrari and saying, ha 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 ha, I have it. You may survive longer if you get an old Plymouth. So you're going to be on display. Does that mean you can't have a red Ferrari if you want one? I should hope not. If that's what you want, go get it. But you get it the old-fashioned way you earn it. Let's have a break. Salu, I will talk until morning. If we might. Here to why we have assembled. It seems like each new step is seemingly, you know, in more scattered direction, but it takes all these scattered steps and all these various talents to be able to assemble a finished product that's worthy of the time invested in the accomplishment. And I'm only going to speak very, very briefly right now, because I would like for Eustace to share some of his own experiences, and I won't ask him to give us a 3-day dissertation in 30 seconds or less about, say, the Federal Reserve System. I'd like for him to talk to us briefly a minute about his own encounters in this incredibly terrible system and why it behooves all of us to give energy and what resources we can muster to move in such a way that we can begin to bring about some changes. I think one of the best books he did of all of his writings was The Rape of Justice. And then you can move into any other book, and please, someone, make a note to get all of Eustace's books assembled for Little Crow. He wants to be better informed about everything that he can be better informed about, because there is a brotherhood, a binding, if you will. I hate this male bonding BS, but there is a soul bonding that happens when brother recognizes brother in that kind of respect. And he would not ask for that. I am asking for that. So if we can please assemble Eustace's work. And if Eustace would please come and speak briefly on this subject, then as we get to the end of this tape, we can start formulating, moving in some direction. And since Gene's not here, if we can just move. And the only reason that I continually refer to Gene is he has assumed, or we've placed him in the position, whichever, doesn't matter, of somewhat being the nucleus or the hub around which we could function, because we had to learn to function in that system. It's there. It's here. And you are. That's all there is to it. It is, and you are, and you're going to have to learn to function within this system as it is, or you'll be put down, because in this world, you do not have the kind of strength to outdo their force. That doesn't mean you don't have the power to totally undo them. So if he would be kind enough.
He has a mic.
Oh, my. Technologically, you're ahead of me. But his isn't on.
It's on. It has to be closer to his.
Yes. Thank you for this opportunity. Coming here has been a very important thing for me. It's been postponed for several years. I've been trying to get out here and haven't done it. But being here, I find, just to have been here today, tremendously clarifies my thinking. It's very interesting because suddenly a lot of things became much clearer to me than they had been. One reason for that is that I work all the time and I don't do much thinking. So being here gives me a chance to do some thinking, and that's very good. And I will say a little bit about my personal background. My ancestors were French Huguenots, and which, of course, were French Protestants. And in France, you had a very rigid class structure of the Catholic Church and the army and the monarchy and the aristocracy. Well, the French began to produce an entrepreneur class of people who were very inventive, very hardworking, and the result was that in this very stagnant French economy, the Huguenots began to be very productive and also to become very rich, which caused a lot of jealousy and anger. And the church and the state people went to the king and said, "You got to exterminate these people." So they did. They massacred a lot of them, and a lot of them fled. And William Mullins, my ancestor, was one of those who fled. And he went to London, and he became the most successful bootmaker in London because he was a very hard-working person. And then he wasn't satisfied with that. He had escaped with his life. He had a new career. Then there was the New World waiting, and he just decided to go to the New World. So when he got on the Mayflower, because he had already made a lot of money in London, he was the only person on the Mayflower who had a body servant with him. And according to the records of the Mayflower Voyage by William Bradford. And he brought his daughter and his son and his wife, or one of his daughters. He had other family there in London. So the first 4 months that they were at Plymouth Colony, he and his wife and his son all died, leaving one daughter, Priscilla Mullins, who married John Alden. And the Alden family became one of the principal families in the history of the United States. Practically all the New England families later were related to the Alden family, the John Adams family, the Longfellows, and so forth. So I'm just giving you a little background and why I have been in this work for so long. It's sort of, I got into this work without knowing much about this because genealogy is not one of my strong points. But after I'd been in this work for about 40 years, I began to find out a little bit more about my own background, which was very interesting because it explained why I had been doing all this for so long. And, of course, that was reassuring that I hadn't been just wasting my time. Now, through my mother's family, I'm descended from the Shawnee people of Ohio. And as Ezra Pound said to me when he found this out, he said, at least you were from a hunting tribe. And I have always been on the hunt ever since. All of my work has been a hunt. And so I've been hunting and hunting and bringing back things. And when I went to the Library of Congress, when Ezra Pound mentioned the Federal Reserve to me for the first time, I had never heard of it, and like most Americans. And so I thought, what in the world does he want me to go into this very arcane subject for? Not knowing it was the government of the United States, the most powerful entity in the world, probably. And so he sicked me onto them. And, of course, they have always fought back. They never took it lying down. And they immediately opened an FBI file on me, and they give me a very rough time. But my activities really show the importance of the great news that they had cloned a sheep. Now, the message that the elitists are sending to you is that if you want to be immortal and be cloned, you have to be a sheep. So you have to be willing to be trimmed. That's the message you're sending. If you're willing to be clipped every year, then you could be a sheep. That's the only way you could be cloned.
Yes, let's all get fleeced.
In this case, we've been doing the clipping first, right?
Well, yes.
We've been getting clipped all along.
Oh, definitely. So the other thing about the cloning was they immediately raised the specter. Perhaps someone would clone Adolf Hitler. Because the mythology of the 20th century is that Adolf Hitler is the incarnation of evil. In other words, public demonization. Hitler becomes the total figure of evil in the world, which is kind of nice because if Hitler's gone, it means we have no evil in the world. Well, that is very good to know. At the Nuremberg trials, they tried the German politicians and generals, but there was one German officer that was never put on trial, and he was Baron Kurt von Schroeder, who was Hitler's personal banker. And another person who was not put on trial at the Nuremberg trials was Montague Norman, the governor of the Bank of England, because the Bank of England had totally financed the Hitler regime. So if Hitler was so evil, why didn't they go after these evil bankers who had put him in power? Of course they didn't, and they never will, because by talking about how evil Hitler was, and you never mentioned the Bank of England. So Hitler's not with us, but the Bank of England is still here. So therefore, I find the Bank of England of more concern than I do Adolf Hitler. But at any rate, cloning does give you the... here again, they're emphasizing all the wrong things. They're trying to mislead you. Instead of getting you to think about E or A, they want you to think about M and N. Skip the first half of the alphabet and not know what's going on. So the adventure of my life has been to bring the real issues before the people. Instead of talking about the Democratic Federal Reserve Party and the Republican Federal Reserve Party, I talk about the Federal Reserve And you can talk about the Democrats and Republicans all you want, but I really have no interest in them. And in fact, when Contact printed my article, Why Dole Threw the 1996 Election, and no one else has made this point, it hasn't appeared anywhere else, the fact that the Federal Reserve System wants to maintain the two-party system. They want a Democratic and Republican Party, and unfortunately, the Democrats have been a minority party for the last 40 years because they became a minority party by the extreme left wing of the Democratic Party took over the entire party, which left the Republican Party in sole charge representing the whole conservative middle class of the United States. And also, the Democratic Party betrayed black Americans because black Americans are usually rather conservative. So the Democratic Party lumped them all into the extreme left wing and, as I say, sold out the black America by committing them to this extreme left wing party when they're actually Republicans at heart because they are conservative people. So these are the realities which our pundits never address because their mission is to keep us in the dark, of course. And this is the reason that they don't address the issues. So I was fortunate enough to go to the insane asylum and meet a man there who knew what was going on, which is why he was there, which is why he was a political prisoner. He was a political prisoner in an insane asylum because they didn't want to try him, and their excuse for not trying him was that he was incompetent. So they kept him there 13 and a half years without trial. And for about 10 years, I accepted this. You know, you tend to accept a great deal. I accepted the fact that he was being imprisoned without trial because he had a lawyer in New York. And not knowing much about lawyers at that time, I thought a lawyer is a person who defends the interests of his client. I didn't know that his lawyer, Julian Cornell, was being paid to keep Ezra in the insane asylum. And that's where he stayed, and they intended to keep him there the rest of his life. Well, as I say, after about 10 years or so, I began to realize that this was not kosher. Things were not what they were supposed to be. And I began to scout around, and I met a congressman who owed a friend of mine a debt, a political debt. And this, when I first started trying to help Ezra, I found out that the going rate on Capitol Hill for intervening on someone's behalf, this was in 1950, was $5,000. Well, neither I nor anybody else that was visiting Ezra had $5,000, so it didn't look too good. That would be equivalent to about $60,000 in today's dollars. And so the years dragged by, and we weren't able to do anything, and finally, a journalist friend of mine named Rex Lightman had a congressman there from North Dakota named Usher Burdick, who had been elected by Rex's father, who owned a newspaper in North Dakota. So Usher Burdick, to repay his political debt to the Lightmans, agreed to go on the floor of Congress and ask a question. He went on the floor of Congress and he said of Ezra Pound, "Why is the government holding this man?" Which was a logical question. And there was no answer because there was no reason. And so they held an 8-minute hearing and dropped all charges against Ezra Pound. Now, when I first visited Ezra Pound, I asked him what conditions he would leave his imprisonment. And he said, "Only if they will drop all charges against me." Well, I thought he really was insane when he said that, but he turned out to be right. It took 13 years, but he walked out a free man after 13 and a half years. So he never modified his position. He never recanted. In fact, they put him in the insane asylum because they asked him, how are you going to defend yourself against this charge of treason? It's very interesting that Ezra was charged with treason for speaking up for the Constitution of the United States, which is what David Miller now is indicting judges on, a charge of constructive treason. and perjury because they lied when they took their office, oath of office to uphold the Constitution. And Ezra Pound in 1948 was telling me that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt committed perjury when he took his oath of office, and he lied when he said he swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States. So this charge has been around for quite a long time. And it's still the best charge that we can make against any official. I don't care if it's the local Tehachapi janitor. If he took an oath to uphold the Constitution, then he is bound by that oath. And that comes before anything else. Whether he's stealing money, whether he's lying, the fact that he committed perjury and he took the oath of office is the crucial factor, which binds every judge in the United States. And David Miller has now given us the weapon to go after the judges on charges of perjury and constructive treason. Now, I only encountered David Miller's work a couple of days ago. I was so impressed by it that when I returned to Virginia, I will be filing a number of notices in my $10 million lawsuit in Massachusetts. First, that I am appearing as a citizen in property, not as a pro se or pro propria persona. And second, that one of the opposing lawyer, I had not used the term pro se in my pleadings in this case, yet the opposing attorney, in referring to me in his in a motion, commented that the plaintiff is appearing pro se. So I didn't know why he made that error, but he did make an error. He was setting it up for a dismissal by putting it on the record that I was pro se. And, of course, in law you have to answer everything and deny everything, and I had not bothered to deny that I was appearing pro se because it didn't seem important at the time. But after hearing David Miller's tapes, I realized that had been done very deliberately to provide the grounds for dismissing this case without a hearing, as they've done in so many of my other cases. And in fact, I will be reopening all of my lawsuits over the last 50 years because they were dismissed because I was appearing pro se, and they did not inform me of that, which meant there was collusion and conspiracy, and of course there's no statute of limitations on conspiracy. So now I can go back down the line and reopen all of my lawsuits, and they will have absolutely no recourse. In other words, not only am I going to get the $10 million in Massachusetts, but I have some $100 million lawsuits, $120 million lawsuits, and so forth. So when I get all this money, I think we'll build a big building out here about 15 stories high.
No, he'll call it the George Green Center. He learns.
Well, George will claim that he gave me the idea, yeah. So I'll have to name it after him. He'll say, you got that for me, you know.
Besides, you carried your books.
Oh, yes. But one thing that has bothered me over the recent years, and I've said this to my audiences in recent years, that I've been in this work now over 50 years, and I began to think I've been writing about criminals all this time, and I tell them that it seems like I've spent my life in the sewers, and maybe I'm getting a little tired of that. But again, I realize it's necessary because if you do not know what crimes have been committed against you and who committed those crimes, then you can't do very much about it. In other words, if you're going to be a plaintiff, you've got to find a defendant. And these people are the defendants. And I have always been the plaintiff in my lawsuits. So when people come to me and they say, I need help because I'm a defendant, I say, well, I've never been a defendant, so I don't really know what I can do. But, of course, I could do a lot. But the important thing is never be a defendant, because when you're a defendant, as David Miller says, the plaintiff is the movement and the person who determines the direction of the lawsuit. All the defendant can do is defend himself. And you spend all your time defending yourself, which means you don't have any time to develop your own strategy or your counter-strategy. Now, in boxing matches, the announcers always point out that one or the other of the two fighters is determining the direction of the action. He's attacking or he's moving the other guy around to get him into a position where he can knock him out.